It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Adkot Ramachandran, who will be speaking on technology, economic growth, and sustainable development. Dr. Ramachandran obtained his master's degree and PhD in mechanical engineering from Purdue University, USA. On his return to India, Dr. Ramachandran joined as a first faculty member in the mechanical engineering department at the Indian Institute of Science. During the period 1957 to 67, he was the head of the Department of Mechanical Engineering. During his stay at the Institute, Dr. Ramachandran established a number of graduate programs and a school of research in energy, heat, and mass transfer, which attracted a number of scholars and visiting professors. His research achievements were recognized by several national and international organizations. In 1967, he was invited to become the director of the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras. In 1973, he was invited to assume the position of secretary to the Government of India in the newly established Department of Science and Technology, and later on, the Director General, the Council of Scientific and Industrial Research. During the period 1973 to 78, Dr. Ramachandran was responsible for establishment of several new research organizations in India, including the National Remote Sensing Agency, the Science and Engineering Research Council, the National Information System for Science and Technology. From 1978 to
1993, Dr. Ramachandran served as Under Secretary General and Executive Director of the newly established United Nations Center for Human Settlement, Habitat. Recently, in February 1995, the Building and Social Housing Foundation of United Kingdom presented him the World Habitat Award at London in recognition and appreciation of his invaluable work at United Nations Center for Human Settlement, which brought new life and hope to millions of homeless families around the world. He was awarded the 1986 Heat Transfer Memorial Award by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers at California. Several universities in India and abroad have conferred on him honorary doctorates. Presently, Dr. Ramachandran is the chairman of the National Advisory Committee for Renewable Energy, Integrated Coastal Zone Management and Urban Planning System set up by the Government of India. May I now request Ramachandran to deliver his talk.
Let me also thank Dr. Ramana and his distinguished colleagues for inviting me to give a talk, because there was a great deal of hesitation that I accepted the invitation, because there are so many distinguished scholars of this institute and of other institutes around here that I hesitated to speak on a subject which I thought would be of interest to a wide spectrum of people. Distinguished participants, I have chosen the subject technology, economic growth, and sustainable development. Since modern technology has made possible the interpenetration of societies, thus giving us for the first time in history both global problems and a global economy. Today, problems are made global by a world system which is shaped by the forces of science, technology, and communications. Has effectively integrated its component parts, eroding the traditional insulators of time and space, and has changed one's notions of resource frontiers, taking them into the darkness of outer space and into the depths of oceans. Humankind has known three economic revolutions: agricultural, industrial, and informatics. We are now on the threshold of a fourth one, environmental. One which will make environmental performance and sustainability being prerequisites for economic growth and global competitiveness. Much of the current technology, which has its roots in the late 19th and early 20th century, will soon become outdated. After all, if you see the automobile, it was discovered 100 years ago. Same applies to many of the other technologies. We have reached a watershed when it comes to technology, a marker between the present and the future. From now on, the key words will be resource use. reduce, reuse, recycle, repair, etc. More and more of the focus of scientists and technologists will be in such things as clean production processes, clean products, energy efficiency, cogeneration, pollution prevention methods, robotics, new materials, fuel, alternative fuels, and many of these things are areas which could be elaborated in detail. All of this is not the message coming out of the Earth Summit of 1992, but it's a growing consensus among scientists, technologists, and even from industry. For nowhere is the need to reconcile the imperatives of environmental integrity and economic growth by means of a sustainable development path more urgent than in the world's urban areas. In the next century, for the first time in human history, the majority of the world's population will be living and working in urban areas, where already over 60% of the gross domestic product is produced, where also most of the emissions, or most of the resources are transformed into products, where also most vehicular and industrial emissions originate, and more where most waste are also generated. The world of cities will increasingly dominate human settlements in the next century. Neither war, nor natural disasters, nor even government policies have been able to stem this trend. The challenge of sustainable development is therefore how we will live and work in cities and towns in the next century, how we manage economic growth there will to a large degree determine the quality of life of its inhabitants and the ecological future of this planet. As we look towards the 21st century, two prospects appear almost certain: continued growth of the global population and continued growth of the world economy. By mid-21st century, the world population will probably stabilize at 10 billion, and the output of the global economy, now about $16 trillion, could be 5 times larger. If we maintain our present practices, such growth cannot occur without the consumption of tremendous quantities of natural resources and consequent environmental degradation. The only way out of this dilemma appears to be technological change and technological progress. As has been pointed out many in the scientific community, environmental degradation is related to population growth, income levels, and pollution intensity of production. In theory, therefore, environmental degradation could be controlled by lowering one or all of these factors. In fact, the truth is that it will take close to a miracle to stabilize global population at double the level of today sometime in the next century. Furthermore, increases of income levels and living standards is a basic aspiration of most humankind. It is, after all, the reason all of us get up every morning to go to work. Such rapid economic development is certainly a basic goal of the people of developing countries like ours, where 80% of the world population will be living. All of this gives continued economic growth powerful momentum. For sound political reasons, it cannot be opposed. Nor can it be opposed out of sound moral and ethical reasons, since it is required to lift much of the population out of poverty and human misery. In the light of all this, it becomes clear that the factor in the equation which will be most susceptible to manipulation is the pollution intensity of production. As well as the consumption level within the production process of natural resources and the environmental quality of the products produced by that process. In fact, technological change is essential just to avoid further deterioration. Even today, unacceptable levels
of atmospheric and aquatic pollution will rise unless the percentage of annual growth in global economic output is matched by an annual decline in pollution intensity. That technology should have such a key role to play should really not come as a surprise to any of us assembled here. After all, from humankind's earliest beginnings, technology has been the main agent of change in the struggle upwards from subsistence towards a decent, healthier, and longer life. Technology and the central role of technology in economic and social advancement is no new phenomenon. What is different today is that global environmental decline has given a new dimension to technology and technical innovation. Today, technology must not only guarantee economic growth and provide relief from poverty and hunger, but also ensure the ecological integrity of our planet. What will be required are technologies which are not, like many technologies today, economic successes, but ecological failures. One can give examples of many of these things at the present time. Already, dramatic progress has been made in advanced materials and biotechnology, as well as in information technologies and miniaturization of products. They all have the potential to provide new products and processes which will fulfill both economic goals and environmental acceptance. Furthermore, investment in environment-friendly or green technologies represent an opportunity to enhance competitiveness. Business opportunities in industrial anti-pollution measures and energy efficiency are at present highly profitable. What is required to capitalize on this potential, however, is a more conducive regulatory framework, one which favors new technologies and focus on pollution prevention measures rather than end-of-pipe pollution controls. This emphasis on clean production processes and cleaner products is what makes the environmental revolution in industry a truly scientific and technological challenge. Such cleaner processes and cleaner products are required across a very wide range of industries and sectors. I should like, however, to cite only three examples. The first of these is energy and transportation. Linked as they are to atmospheric pollution, global warming, and climate change, a prime environmental issue of our day. Even though opinions may vary over the extent and speed of global climate change, if current practices persist, there is nevertheless a clear consensus that it is better to reduce greenhouse gas emissions now than to risk paying for costly remedial action later. Moreover, in many of the world's major urban areas, Bangalore included, the risks in air pollution are already self-evident. Smog emergencies have closed schools and factories in Mexico, in Athens, in Bangkok. Air pollution has become a threat to both health and productivity. The World Health Organization studies on Bangkok have clearly indicated that children have lost 4 to 5 IQ points because of leaded petrol being used extensively. I notice here that we have lead-free petrol in the 4 metropolitan cities, and I don't know wonder why it's not included in Bangalore, because Bangalore is the second largest number of vehicles, next only to Delhi. In the past 4 decades, fossil fuel use has accelerated rapidly, with carbon emissions over the period totaling 130 billion metric tons. Improving energy efficiency in transportation, in industry, in the home, in lighting, space heating, space cooling, and domestic appliances certainly is one way to reduce carbon emissions. But with our developing world's share of world energy consumption set to double over the next 30 years, as a logical requirement of economic growth and development, energy efficiency will not be enough if fossil fuels alone are relied on for power and transport. there may be a reduced rate of buildup of greenhouse gases, but it would still increase already high global levels, whereas a decline is what is required. Particularly significant is the prospect of increased power generation in countries like China and India using fossil fuels, given that power generation from fossil fuels already produce 27% of global carbon emissions. Increased fossil fuel consumption in developing countries without a corresponding decline in consumption in the industrialized countries could thus offset whatever advances may be made worldwide to reduce emissions. Certainly, in the long term, development of advanced energy technologies such as fission and fusion reactors, fuel cells, solar energy systems, and technologies based on hydrogen are sound options. They may be more expensive to install, they may still need to be perfected, but this, of course, is part of the challenge that humankind faces in the energy area. But over their life cycle, I believe, they can be cost-effective alternatives which are essential for a sustainable energy future. We already witnessed here the blackouts that we are having, and you can imagine what can happen in the next century if something is not done in this area for a sustainable energy future. A great part of the energy pollution equation is naturally the ubiquitous motor vehicle. At the present time, automotive vehicles, two and three wheelers, cars, buses, trucks, account for 14% of carbon emissions, and this share is increasing. They are also responsible for most of the urban smog. In Los Angeles, which is notorious for the urban smog, they have introduced a law that with effect from next year, 2% of the vehicles in the Los Angeles metropolitan area have to be battery-operated vehicles. No wonder there's such a clamor and competition among the automotive industries around the world to produce these kind of vehicles. With the expected doubling of the global motor vehicle population from 500 million today to 1 billion early in the next century, sweeping changes will be required to protect the urban areas from dangerous effects of smog. In the short term, fuel efficiency and other measures to reduce motor vehicle pollution may help, but in the medium and long term, the solution is for transport, whether individual or collective, to be based on non-polluting fuels. This, of course, leads us inevitably to the discussion of the so-called zero-emission vehicles. Passenger cars, which will be powered either by greatly improved batteries or by fuel cells or by hydrogen. Although still in the prototype phase, with many problems still to be resolved, these new type of vehicles present a revolution in themselves, affecting entire sectors of industry, with scientists and technologists playing a major part in making it happen. Similar changes are required in mass transportation from polluting to less or non-polluting forms of transport. Certainly, buses using liquefied natural gas, as in Japan or Italy, as fuel is one step in the direction. In Bangkok recently, they have introduced the three-wheelers with battery operation. In the future, however, the solutions will also have to include a greater reliance on electric light rail, especially reduced traffic congestion and pollution in urban areas. We in this country abolished trams, while in Europe they have only made better and more efficient trams. Any city which has a population of more than 2 million, if it does not have electric light rail transportation, will have the traffic congestion that we are now experiencing in this beautiful city. Lenin passed a law in 1923 in the former Soviet Union that all cities with a population of more than 1 million will immediately get a metro. That is one of the reasons why you see in all the cities of the former Soviet Union, we have metro trains operating. Their cost per passenger per kilometer, their cost per ton per kilometer is far less than buses and trucks, and the cost of roads and highways were never included in the so-called feasibility studies that we made in the transportation planning during the last 2 to 3 decades. The second area of concern of the three which I had mentioned earlier is the globe's ever-shrinking freshwater supply. Earth may well be the water planet, but less than 3% of the global supply of freshwater takes part in the hydrological cycle, and only half of this is surface water. Yet the perception that water is a finite resource to be conserved and protected is relatively new and unfortunately not universally shared. For too long, water has been treated as an unlimited resource that is provided either freely or as cheaply as possible and in any quantity desired. Yet by the year 2000, many countries will have only about half as much water per capita as they had in 1975, and may well experience much greater demands from industry and agriculture. Wastage, I would like to prefer the use word squandered, is another reason for water scarcity. More than a third of the water treated at high cost to serve the needs of our burgeoning cities is unaccounted for, within quotation, or lost before it reaches the intended consumers. I would like all of you to imagine the reaction of the shareholders of an oil company if they were told that one third of their liquid gold was unaccounted for or lost in transmission. Yet lack of water will soon be seen to be at least as critical as lack of oil in conditioning the pace of our national development. Clearly, unless nations practice more efficient water conservation, future shortages are likely to limit economic growth and jeopardize health and quality of life. If one adds to this the increasing consumption of fresh water as a consequence of population growth and hopefully improved levels of economic development in the coming decades, it becomes clear that we are rapidly being confronted with a challenge of immense proportions. At the 1992 International Conference on Water in Dublin, Ireland, I refer to the possibility of a water shock similar or more serious than the oil shock of the 70s in many countries, especially in the next century, if present trends in water management continue. You have already heard of water shortages even in cities like New York, Los Angeles, Columbus, etc. We are all familiar with the water shortages of our neighboring city, Madras. I'm afraid this is an area which requires high priority attention in the coming years. Apart from such issues as pricing and household use of water, where certainly greater efficiencies can be achieved, and technical matters such as water leakages in supply networks, it is clear that much of the burden of protecting the world's fresh water supply will fall on industry and agriculture, the main consumers of fresh water in production processes, as well as the source of much water pollution. In some very large urban areas, the daily outpour of industrial waste into water bodies and rivers reach millions of cubic meters. Certainly, this situation is unsustainable over time, particularly in the light of increasing water demands. What we must aim for is conservation, reuse, and ultimately zero discharge. And this requires a technological transformation along the entire production processes. A tremendous challenge, but also, I should dare say, a tremendous opportunity, which many countries the world over have already decided to embrace. For instance, Mercedes-Benz is making headlines in newspapers, has reduced consumption of fresh water from 22.2 cubic meters per vehicle to just 3.5 cubic meters per vehicle because it has invested in a water recycling plant. The third significant area of concern that I would like to identify is waste and waste management. Since the earliest ancestors of man appeared on this planet 4 million years ago, one human characteristic has remained. We have always left our rubbish lying all around. We have even littered the outer space in the recent decades. But there is now no doubt that humanity is paying a high price for littering the globe. Hundreds of our lakes, rivers, and coastal waters are no more than open sewers incapable of sustaining life. In thousands of landfills, hazardous wastes have been dumped without control and without provision to ensure that these wastes do not pollute groundwater reserves. One of the things that surprised me coming back after a decade being abroad is to see a lot of people carrying Bisleri bottles along with them in the airplane or in the train. This was not so prior to 1985. The cost today of having to deal with many years of little or no control are staggering. Clearly, this process cannot continue indefinitely. We must find ways to reduce waste and to manage what waste is generated in a more sound and efficient manner. This will not be just a challenge for us scientists and engineers in the years ahead, but for all people and particularly for government, industry and agriculture as well. Another emerging environmental concern is the cumulative impacts of many small, diffuse and ubiquitous pollution sources, which can be as significant as a few large or stationary industrial sources. Traditional centralized command and control regulation on stationary sources are poorly suited for reduction from diffuse sources of pollution. Smokestacks, I refer to chimneys, and effluent discharges were very easy targets for regulation and control. New pollution regulation and control policies must also address non-point sources. Example, landfills. Runoff from urban streets, runoff from irrigated farmlands, because they have nowadays given a lot of fertilizers and pesticides, and poorly managed forestry products, which contribute to water quality problems. Mobile point sources, which I already referred to, and other mobile non-point sources, which affect air quality. Dr. Raman and I are very familiar with these open fires in the streets of Delhi between the months of December, January and February, causing in smog, and almost all airplane flights from Delhi are delayed by at least 3 hours between the hours of 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. There was no such thing before, prior to 1950. Distinguished participants, greater attention have to be given in the coming years to life cycle impact analysis of manufacturing processes and the opportunities for material conservation, energy reduction, and waste minimization. It is now widely accepted that it is easier to prevent pollution than to try and clean up the environment. The two types of costs, prevention versus cleanup, are not, however, borne by the same parties. Global competitive forces and concern for legal liability with hazardous waste disposal will lead to reduced waste. It is also apparent that regulators are shifting their focus from the factory or the chimney to the impact of using a company's products and their disposal. This implies that in future, companies will be held responsible not only for the impacts of the production processes, example emissions and effluents, but also consumer use and disposal of their products. Example, using recyclable and non-toxic packaging materials. This cradle-to-grave responsibility for disposal of products may soon become the norm in almost all countries. Already, this has been proposed for car batteries, a fee for environmental disposal of lubricated oils, and fast food companies are making efforts to recycle their fast food containers, and several car manufacturers, notably BMW and Benz, are experimenting with dismantling their old models so that the original materials can be recycled. According to the Vice President Technology and Environment of Benz, the number of scrap cars in Germany in the year 1990 alone totaled 2 million, leading to a continuous increase in the volume of waste to be disposed of while landfill area is shrinking. It is for this reason that most of the industrialized countries are trying to dump their hazardous and other waste in African countries, and there is now a UN protocol that such waste cannot be accepted in the developing countries of Africa. About 75% of the materials used in disused cars can be recycled. The use of plastics is inevitable for reasons of lightweight construction, safety and comfort. The reprocessing and reutilization of plastics constitute a major challenge to the scientific community. The question posed is, should plastics be used to make new products or used as a fuel to generate energy? Both Benz in Germany and Mitsubishi in Japan have set up a plant to generate energy from the plastics, while Volvo of Sweden has adopted an international code to identify plastics used in their vehicles that can be recycled and others that can be used for energy generation. This new focus on downstream impact will shift responsibilities to industries, companies, firms. Currently, most products are designed with little consideration of their ultimate disposability. As a consequence, and in order to encourage better product design, the European Union, and in particular Germany, has enacted legislation that will increase manufacturers' responsibility for environmentally safe disposal of their products. As part of this trend, all of you are aware that environmental labeling is resorted to in countries like US, UK, and Germany. Achieving the environmental and economic benefits of high recycling rates will demand the efforts and skills of scientists, technologists, and policymakers. They must respectfully develop their technologies and provide the incentives to get both producers and consumers on board. As I mentioned earlier, distinguished participants, we stand on the threshold of a new economic revolution based on new, cleaner and more sophisticated production processes and on new and cleaner recyclable products. The European Union is insisting on strict environmental standards of products and even processes which anyone wishing to do business there cannot afford to ignore, and this approach is spreading to other parts of the world. We are aware of the problems that our leather industry and textile industries are facing because of the use of certain kinds of dyes. Mr. Darbari said, Chairman Emeritus of Tata Chemicals recently told me that importers in Germany of their products in plastic barrels insisted that they take back the empty plastic barrels. Imagine the shipping costs unless they find a purchaser or a recycler in Germany. Such a revolution in the production line will demand a much better trained, better educated, more technically competent and sophisticated workforce. The countries whose educational and social environment produces such a workforce will take the lead in the 21st century. The four Asian tigers have a fantastic secondary education program, and it's for this reason that they are being able to be retrained every 2 years to meet the production demands of their country. Lastly, what the 21st century will require is a new class of administrators, business executives and managers, aware of environmental issues and limitations and able to incorporate them in the long-term planning. They must be capable of understanding all sides of the debate concerning technological development. They must be ready to act responsibly and with the interests of the planet and the future of humanity in mind. That will not be an easy task, I'm sure of, but it is a task which must be done if we are to survive and compete globally. For as the president of the International Chamber of Commerce remarked in Rio, and I quote, "A versatile, dynamic, responsive, and profitable private sector will be the main source of the financial, technical, and management resources needed to address the dual challenge of environment and development," end quote. With the foregoing efforts, human society will still be far from sustainable as long as the full value of the environment resource is not reflected in the prices according to which business and consumers make their choice in the marketplace. In these races, such issues as life cycle costing and end of life cycle consequences of products and processes, all of which will have greater prominence in the business and industrial culture of the 21st century. The question is therefore not who is going to pay for sustainable development. That is a question reflecting the old defensive mentality of environment protection. But how can business and industry fully integrate
the value of environment into their operations, thereby not only conserving the natural resources for future generations, but also using the environment as a renewable resource for sustainable economic growth. It is these challenges, the challenges of a competitive global economy and sustainable economic growth, and how to prepare for them is uppermost in the minds of the scientific and technological community. Where countries once fought for colonial conquest, they are now fighting for markets and technology within a global marketplace. The conflict is real, as each nation is trying to create more jobs and increase income at home to the detriment of its competitors. Scientists and technologists have become important weapons in this new form of economic warfare, as modern environment-friendly technologies are incorporated into consumer products or fast-growing services that flood the world markets today. Researchers at Stanford and Harvard, in their study on the economic growth of the Asian tigers and of the industrialized countries, concluded, and I quote, "A pro-economic growth policy must therefore have three parts. It should be pro-investment, pro-technology, and pro-education. Technology and financial capital are complements. They reinforce each other, and together are the major factors that can raise the growth rate and improve the standard of living and the quality of jobs, a true indicator of a nation's welfare." I see some distinguished economists here. I'm sure that we have many of the technologies, but we do not have the capital to build it. I'm sure Dr. Ramana can tell us that if they had the capital, they would reach the 10,000 megawatt capacity for nuclear power as was envisaged in 1990. All of this, of course, clearly points to need for a technology policy suitable to the social, political, and economic realities facing our country today and in the coming decades. Such a policy should broadly comprise of a strong support for technology development that promotes reserve conservation and is environment friendly. A strong support for education at all levels, from primary to the highest levels, since retraining three times in one's working life will become an absolute necessity to avoid obsolescence in the 21st century. We do not then have to worry about exit programs and what kind of handshake is it? Golden handshakes. Strategic fundings of research for self-reliance in vital sectors such as national security, food security, and health security. Facilitate joint research consortia between industry and publicly funded organizations to promote technological innovations for sustainable development. We should not have any inhibitions, whether it is in the public sector or in the private sector. A loosening of command and control regulations and replacement by incentives. This, I feel, is most important. A stable, low inflation macroeconomic policy which favors investment in physical, human, and technological capital. I am reminded of the famous firm Halson Chemical Industries, which was a pioneer in developing R&D in the field of petrochemical industries and sold its processes and technologies all over the world. But it had borrowed heavily. But when the inflation went up in the United States during President Jimmy Carter's time, he appointed Paul Volcker as the Governor of the Reserve Bank, who raised interest rates to practically 16%, something similar to what is happening in our country at the present time. Who will be in a position to borrow at such high interest rates, and what profits would they have to make in order to repay it? A trade policy that encourages competition, a tax structure that favors savings and investments, enable banking and non-banking financial institutions with improved mechanisms for allocation of capital, particularly for the infrastructure sector. We have neglected our infrastructure during the last 20 years, and we are paying for it now. And I don't know how we are going to get all the infrastructure back on its feet within the next 5 years. Training and information programs on intellectual property rights and patents is becoming increasingly important. Incentives for technology upgradation of small firms where generally innovation originates. And last, but by no means least, improve governance in both public and private sectors through participatory processes reduce inefficiencies and rigidities, and motivate partnerships. The bridging of the technology, environment, and economic policy is vital for economic growth, social equity, and global competitiveness for sustainable development in the 21st century, and to assure the millions of our people that still elusive goal, a healthy, productive, working, and living environment for all. I thank you.
Mr. Ramchandran, I think we were quite justified in showing great keenness and enthusiasm to have Professor Ramchandran address us this evening. It's a very careful address with the latest figures and very useful to the wide range that he covered, to the wide interest that exists in this hall. Now, it is our usual tradition that we ask questions, make quick comments, and make full use of the time of Professor Ramchandran while he's here. We have to, of course, close for lunch, but there is still quite a lot of time, at least half an hour, and then I'll finish with a formal vote of thanks. Dr. Ramchandran has agreed to answer any questions and listen to any comments.
I agree with you, Mr. Satish Chandra. If you are expecting somebody to give you from manna, you are out for being disillusioned. I am not one of those who believe that we should wait for somebody to give us. We have to do it in our own self-interest, what is necessary to protect our environment. You mentioned about fluorocarbons, CFCs. I oppose the idea of going from CFCs to HCFCs and then to HFCs. That is a disastrous route which is being supported by the concerned governments of the West. We have to see, and we have time till 2010. After all, we have only 3 CFC plants in this country, and they have been invested in the early 80s, and we are mostly supporting to the Middle East countries. Now, it's necessary that they have to modify their processes to produce HFCs to use in refrigerators, and not to use it also in the foam pillows, foam mattresses, etc., or for cleaning in the case of electronic companies. This whole idea of $125 billion was more a negotiable one, and I think they were wanting to get the developing countries to agree to all the things that were said at Rio in the hope that they will get the money. We ourselves signed the Montreal Protocol rather hastily without getting China's support. And China, I was present there. And we lost out there. We could have put a much longer and tougher fight. But I'm fairly certain that if we are going to protect our resources and our environment, we have to do our homework much more within the country. I totally agree with you that there is no equity in this whole business. Most of the countries, as I indicated in my statement, are trying to protect the markets, protect their jobs, and protect the income. That is one of the reasons I use the word, within quotations, economic warfare. And that is what we are in for the next decade, whether we like it or not.
Yes, General.
Let me answer the first question. In the Middle East countries, particularly in Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, there are plants converting salt water into fresh water through the desalination process. It is costly, but they are prepared to pay $1 for a gallon of water. You must know it's certain costs involved. And therefore, there is no question that desalination is feasible, but the cost will come down if more and more plants are put into operation and we gain much more experience. Quite a lot of work is being done. As for wave energy, it's still very elementary stages. There are much better renewable sources of energy which can be exploited, whether it's solar thermal, solar photovoltaic, biomass, biogas. All these are available. The real reason why they are not developing is, we tell them, you shall not have subsidies. But we forget how much subsidies we give to oil and coal. And if they are taken into account, then certainly renewable energy resources can be comparable cost-wise, as also taking the cost, life cycle cost. There is no fuel supply for 20 years in these renewable energy resources, free. Whereas you have to increase the cost of the fuel annually, and it's increased over a 20-year period.
I want to compare South Korea and India in 1962. Both of us had the same per capita income of $300 per year. Today, South Korea per capita income is 10 times what it was in 1962, whereas we have remained more or less marginal.
I think the whole approach has to be from that point of view. It can be done. It must be done. And will have to be done. You are saying our people are poor. I have seen in the slums and shanty towns of both Asia and Africa that the poor people are willing to buy water 2 rupees per bucket, 3 rupees a bucket. But all of us living in urban areas don't pay at that rate. If it is a necessity, even poor people are willing to sacrifice something else to pay. So the question of the poor people not willing to buy is something that has to be given up. And that's one of the reasons why we are advocating higher pricing, for example, of water. The same applies to what you speak about in buying wood. If you give them an alternative supply, they will certainly go for it. Yeah, certainly. I mean, nothing is free. This is one of the things we have been taught in the last 40 years that government will give everything. And unfortunately, that has been a major problem that we are facing now. To remove anything that has been given is exceedingly difficult. Exceedingly difficult. And I think it's a question of giving free electricity to our farmers or free water to our farmers. Look at the amount of water that is used in agriculture operations in Israel. Now, every chief minister, everybody is going to Israel to see how water is being used, sprinkler irrigation, etc. Why can't we not practice? We have to impress on the farmers that they are not going to get it free and give them 3 years' time. I even made a proposal, Dr. Ramana, that let's put solar photovoltaic pumps in the farms, pay the entire amount capital, but then tell them no more free electricity, they will have to maintain it and operate. Or even use a biomass plant, etc. I think we have to come to a situation where there is no other alternative but to educate our people. And our major problem has been the lack of emphasis on primary education, both in urban and rural areas. As far as discipline is concerned, there is no substitute for self-discipline. If we are not going to observe traffic rules, if we are not going to observe that cutting trees is going to harm future generations, then we have no future. You should see the Chinese people, how they look after their environment, how they keep it very clean. This is something that we have to inculcate in our people, and that will only come through it.
Yes, sir.
I made a statement some nearly 30 years ago of the industrial military complex, and he mentioned that if only we reduced the military expenditure in that country by 1%, he said they could provide all the needs of all the poor people, not only in the United States, but of the whole world. But this is an area which is more political than rational discussion can take. I totally agree with you on the reduction of defense expenditure. But how do you deal with our decision makers who say so-and-so is arming, therefore we must rearm? How do you tell our defense personnel that you go and fight with arms which are much more superior on the other side? Until we have a genuine understanding between the countries, at least within the neighboring countries, reduction of defense expenditure is going to continue. I hope only it will stabilize at the levels at which it is happening now, and there won't be an armament race. The Soviet Union was destroyed because of the armament race, not because of its policy. There's interest on conservation of lakes at the present time in several states in India, because they have been neglecting maintenance of lakes. I think there was a report by Mr. Lakshman Rao of this city about the number of lakes which have been, shall we say, filled with rubbish and settlements come on. It should never have been allowed. I only hope that this new decentralization which is being talked about will be effective in the coming decades, because then the local people will prevent their resources being exploited by the urbanites, as you say, or by other vested interests. Inherently, our people have a love for their nature. They would like to protect it, but they are overruled by what I would like to call mafia gangs, who are now exploiting our land resources, our lakes, and our rivers, and in effect preventing ordinary people from complaining. I only hope that the non-governmental organizations will take up this very vigorously. Certainly. There have been many studies, particularly in the case of lake conservation, river conservation, even in the case of oceans now. There's a considerable interest. But we have to have the backing of the people. How do we educate our masters? This is our major problem. How do we educate our masters that what they are doing is not in the long-term interest of the country? By masters, I mean not only politicians, not only bureaucrats, but also the public at large.
Shridhar?
Because this whole business of gender discrimination is something worldwide. And possibly... Okay, I follow about, you mentioned caste, you mentioned everything. This is one of the problems that we are looking for social scientists to advise us how to go about it. The major problem is, that's why I use, that any policy cannot be in isolation. It has to be in relation with social realities of the country, the economic realities of the country, and also the political realities. I personally was hoping to suggest to Dr. Rajaramanna, Bangalore is a unique city. It has an institute for social and economic change. It has institutes of management. It has national laboratories. Can we set up a group here to make this technology, economics, and social interface to study what its effect is on technologies which Sri Lata mentioned? I'm fully aware of, because in the area of human settlements, we had a group on women and human settlements. To me, it was a big surprise when I visited Indonesia, particularly in the island of Bali. The women do all the plastering, the painting, everything. Nowhere else in the world have I seen that, only in Indonesia. It is for here we ask them only to take things on their in the basket. So it works from country to country in this whole business of what the technology is done by women and what is done by men. I cannot answer the point you made that women take over the technology developed by men. This is women, technology developed by women, because I personally would like more of a social scientist to answer why it is happening. Social change is continuously taking place, unfortunately too slowly in our country. But I think this whole business of urbanization is going to change that very, very fast. For the first time in human history, I said 51% of the world's population will be living in urban areas. In Africa, by the year 2000, it is going to be 40% or 45%, whereas in Asia, because of China and India, it will remain at 35%. But urbanization is the one which is going to make the greatest social change in the first half of the next century. And hopefully, it will benefit our women and children. The total amount of energy generated by renewable sources is only 800 megawatts, including wind farms, everything. But if you want to, say, have 10% of the total energy generated by 2010, we have to take certain steps as a renewable energy policy. What is wrong if the government tomorrow says that all future public buildings, hotels, hostels, hospitals, will only have solar water heating and will not use electric geysers for heating? It is a policy which can be easily implemented. Israel has done it. Cyprus has done it. Immediately you can have a certain system. Another policy. Why can't we... I mentioned this to the minister the day before yesterday. Why can't we say that compact fluorescent lamps shall only be used in institutes like all these? If you get 60 watt power, but consumption of CFL is only 7 watts. It is true it costs 300 rupees to produce a bulb, but its life is guaranteed for 5 years and can even last more. Energy consumption bills will come down. At least in public buildings they can do it in the future, if not in the past. All replacements can be done. You then, to that extent, you will save investment in new energy generation. Same thing applies. For example, I've been advocating space cooling using vapor absorption systems. The whole of the central government complex need not have 50,000 room air conditioners. They can have centralized cooling system. After all, if the technology is available, it's a chilling system which goes through these things. Just as central heating is done in Moscow, in Helsinki, in many of the other cities. They'll say cost. Yes, but begin it in a small phase. Look at what we have done here. I mentioned it morning to a group of mechanical engineers. We take 15 years to build a 10-kilometer underground in Calcutta, 12 years to build an 8-kilometer MRTS in Madras, and in Singapore, they build a 45-kilometer one in 2 years and 9 months within a time frame and within a cost. We have not put the value of money properly in our whole planning exercise. My friends in the planning commission said, labor intense work, therefore we cut open and close and we took 15 years. The net result is every alternate day there is some problem in the Calcutta metro these days. I think we have to adopt the technology that is suitable for certain kinds of work, especially in macro engineering projects. Here again, many of our hydroelectric projects are taking enormous time. Rather than take 20 projects in order to satisfy all the political demands, better take 2 projects and complete it in a cost frame and in a time frame. And then we will not face the problems that we are facing. Many of the problems that we are facing is, I'm sorry to say, man-made. What we have made. Comes up.
Last question.
No, not that.
But I must say, I was getting a little hesitant, like Professor Ramachandran was, about making my last remarks, which is essentially a vote of thanks. Because I think with the state of my voice, you would say I am one of the victims of pollution, of Makri Circle, because I have to cross Makri Circle sometimes, 3 times, 4 times. And the moment I get to that point, which is very near the Raman Institute, so don't be too cheerful, Krishna. And you begin to cough. It's so obvious. And in the evenings, it becomes blacker than other places. And now here we talk of so many possibilities about beautifying the city. But this is happening right in front of our noses, eyes, and yet we have not been able to do anything about it. Yes, some small reactions were seen. The emission tests took place, but the government vehicles themselves produce more emission than anything you can think of. Nobody bothered. There was immediately a great movement where all the cars went for the emission tests and all that. There were threats. But all this has died out. Now, these are the things which really finally lead to slow improvements in our whole thing. In fact, the crux of Ramachandran's lecture today is we have got all the knowledge, we have got all the people, but we don't implement anything on time. There was talk of the defense expenditure, and I'd like to share my shock. And this was the occasion when I visited Siachen, some 18,000 feet above sea level in the Himalayas. There is a big contingent of troops guarding that border, guarding which border, I don't know, because you see rocks and snow. But that by itself is not the only thing. It's a difficult life to live. The amount of waste that they produce, which is human waste, food waste and all that, will not degrade at that temperature and that pressure. And it has to be stored in tins and kept, and this is being done for more than 15 years. It seems such a shock that such a beautiful place should contain human waste or decaying matter, and nobody can do anything about it, and nobody has thought of a solution over the 15 years. This is one of the things which defense, perhaps without diplomacy, has. I know there was a solution, but it was never implemented. Solution means giving up that place. You shouldn't have armies at 18,000 square feet. That itself is a strange thing. But I had to see this problem of how such occasions are said, no, we have to look after that border, that place, because it's very essentially Pakistan takes this glacier, then we've had it, that kind of thing. Then what can you do? We have to agree to this. And nobody has bothered about it. But I was so happy to see how cheerful all those young boys were going up to the mountains. And they tried to hold me on either side, saying I may collapse because of the low pressure and all that. But then one of them said, nothing, sir, you walk about slowly, go back and take a compost, you'll be all right. Well, that is one of the strange things that I came across. Now, Professor Ramachandran covered a very wide range of possibilities of which we are making attempts but not getting anywhere. I think this is he's been away 10 years and therefore he's picked up a lot of information of what's happening in every country. In fact, I've never had a complete picture of what's the problems of industrialization, problems of power, problems of environment. But it was good to listen to this complete picture from a man who's right on the spot. Now, he did mention about nuclear power. The idea which I had suggested, 10,000 megawatts, was easily available by the end of the century. One of the most difficult things was to get the people to pay for the power.
the ministry says, give it to the farmer. And you say, what about the money for us?
Doesn't matter. Put it next year, next fifth plant.
How can you go on building further plants if crores were negative?
At Rajasthan, UP, various places where we had nuclear power at that time. And each of the earnings was supposed to be for putting up more reactors. No, we had to go to the planning commission. Just haggle with them over various education. Perhaps education came down lower and lower because they had to give money for something else. And as Professor Ramachandran pointed out, our biggest problem has been education. Why is it, of course, the Korean learns faster than us? Is a very big question. I don't know, our mentality is, I know a lot of people who are very educated, but take very obtuse views and continue to say, no, that's not the thing, whatever reasons you give. Our logic has got distorted over the centuries. But I keep telling everybody in my optimism that in the last 3 years, there's a change in the country. I feel a change. People are better dressed. They look better fed. Less women carry heavy things on their head or ugly things on their head. But the government has decided to solve that problem by reservations at the PhD level. So that may solve the problem. We leave it at that. But those people, there is a slight improvement which after so many years of looking at the country, I notice. But with sadness because of the slowness with which all this has happened. This is not happening in Indonesia. Indonesia looks, if you go there, they were so much worse off than us about 20, 30 years ago. And now they are way ahead and calling themselves more advanced country. Now, why this should happen here? I know there's always the usual excuse of population, overpopulation, this, that, and the other thing, but they are excuses. Finally, all that I have like to say is, we would like to blame the politicians too, because they always say many things, but they can't get anything through. Why is it that we cannot get it through? I've never understood. We cannot implement many of the wonderful things that we have suggested here and there, planning commission. But I think it's the way we get, this happens, and I know some of you who are used to dealing with Delhi, how slow the response of the letters, the whole administrative management system. We talk of many management schools here and such things. But the management that is going on in Delhi, in all these important places, is just as it was in not my college time, it was very good. No, I mean the old Governor General time, but I think Cornwallis' time must have been the same thing, pass a letter, some petition, and that goes round and round and probably never reaches its thing. That system still exists. And if I have to put my finger on one point, I think the slowness of the administration management is responsible for many of these things. And this breeds the other thing, be careful, don't spend too much money. If you give too much money, he may run away with it, and therefore it never starts. I've had a case recently where people were saying, no, don't increase the budget. First, let him work with such small quantities. If he's good, then we'll increase it. And that's about half a lakh level, the 50,000 rupee level. But the size of the institution should be of the order of some crores. But that's how they manage. This actually, I've seen it happening at various institutions. Now, I don't have to tell Professor Ramachandran because he's an old colleague of mine and he has seen Delhi inside out, outside in. But he's good that he's in Bangalore. And we in the institute, if he agrees, would love to have him as our life associate. In fact, you'll get a letter very soon. And come occasionally and advise in what way we can help. Of course, we are also a small organization. We'll remain small. I think Professor Ramachandran knows I've had monster organizations with me at one time. So I know which is the better one now. But can we implement these great things that can be done and implement it quickly is something we'd like to discuss with you. And with your influence, perhaps some ministers and things like that. I don't know. I don't have so much contact with the local ministers because I have been away from Karnataka for many years and things have changed here.
I have no contact with either the local or the country.
All right. Then we are no ideally suited people for the situation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, now to the very formal part, I thank Professor Ramachandran for having readily agreed and come with something which is prepared with great thought and spent a lot of effort, and therefore, very happy to have had you this evening, sir. And we also welcome Mrs. Ramachandran in our midst. And I hope she'll visit us now and again. Because we have a group for women's uplift, and perhaps such problems do interest you. and that is Srila Prabhatavan looks after it, but there are always people who can give certain inputs to an organization which is supposed to be free of beggars, supposed to be in inverted commas. But we keep it that way. Thank you very much.